TFM.
Fun will now commence.
Welcome back to The Journey, everyone. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is here on the network, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. We've been swept away to the Delta Quadrant, Matthew, but before we get started, could you just hand me a tricorder?
Yeah. I mean, okay, here
Matthew,
you go.
Matthew, medical tricorder.
What do I look like, a nurse? Dang it, I'm a pilot, not a nurse.
Yes, everyone, we are jumping into Voyager, of course. Matthew and I discussed Deep Space Nine here on the network for many years, also Enterprise. And in honor of Voyager's 30th anniversary, we're going to do what we've been doing with those other shows and do a rewatch. And for us, it could be interesting because, Matthew, I think you and I are the same. Voyager is of the original five series, shall we call them, prior to Discovery coming out. Of those series, I think Voyager is the one we've watched the least.
Absolutely, Chris. You know, we were talking on the other side of the quadrant there, and one of the things that I mentioned is that I know for sure that I have not watched this show since 2005.
Wow.
And I was about to head into my first year of grad school, and I had some time before that began. And because of that, I decided, you know what? I've got the itch to watch all of Voyager again. I had not seen it all since the show had been on. And I bought all the DVDs, and then I rushed through the series very quickly in the span of about 2.5 weeks, and I have not returned to the show since then. And a big part of that has been our work that we do, you know, with Deep Space Nine and all the other stuff that, you know, I do, of course, here on TFM with the 602 Club and lots of stuff that I'm watching for that, you know, and so just really have
and
not
that's
spent
all non-Star Trek stuff, of course.
Yeah, exactly. So yes, that's just not been something that I have really returned to. So I'm actually kind of fascinated for you. You said you're in a similar boat there too, that you haven't watched a lot of Voyager recently.
Yeah similar. Mine's not as extreme as yours. I've of course seen the series all the way through a few times. And in earlier years on the network, when we used to do the Ready Room every week,
sure,
and we rotated through the series, of course, I would watch Voyager episodes,
right,
but they're random episodes. And since we stopped doing the Ready Room weekly, I haven't watched Voyager nearly as much because I haven't had any opportunity to discuss it.
Yeah.
Other than, it feels like it wasn't that long ago, but it was actually in 2020. There's the podcast that I started and which I intend to revive called Interphase. And we did a discussion on there talking about continuity in Deep Space Nine and Voyager, kind of comparing the two.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's probably the last time that I really watched a lot of Voyager to prep for something. These days, I'll occasionally go in and I'll watch a random episode of Voyager that's one of my favorite episodes. But unlike the other series where I'm constantly rewatching episodes, Voyager's one I don't return to all that often. So
yeah,
I'm in a question. Similar boat.
Yeah, I've got a question then. Just interestingly, why, you know, as we're about to dive into this anniversary rewatch, why do you think that Voyager hasn't been like? Is it been one of those things where Voyager just was never your favorite? So when you thought of, oh, I want to pop in a Star Trek episode, that's not what comes to mind. Was there something else about the show that just didn't you just didn't enjoy or something, or was it just maybe it didn't leave enough of an impression on you as a viewer to where there were those episodes that you thought, oh, I have to go back and watch that. The same way somebody might be like, oh, I need to watch, you know, Trials and Tribulations, or I need to watch The Visitor, or The Inner Light, or City on the Edge of Forever. I mean, you know, those type of things. Is that... I'm just kind of wondering where you ended up landing on that.
Well, there are some episodes like that from Voyager that I do really enjoy, and I'll go back and watch. Blink of an Eye is one where they go to the planet where time flows much more rapidly on the surface.
Yeah,
I think it's a really interesting science fiction concept and a really good story. So there are some episodes like that. I think for me, there are a number of reasons. Most of them are probably related to things that were happening in life at the time, which is also why I think there are a lot of people for whom Voyager is their favorite series by far, because it came along at just the right time in their life where it was either their first Star Trek or it was the first one when they were at an age where they could really connect with the messages in Star Trek, and it became their favorite. So for me, and I guess this can take us back also to talking about our memories of the premiere, because it relates to this. Originally, Voyager aired on UPN because it was the flagship show of the new network that was starting. And I was in university at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, and we did not have a UPN affiliate.
Okay.
So we could not see the show. And that was the case for many people around the country. They couldn't actually watch Voyager because there was no way to get it. So that was probably one reason why, not the premiere in particular, because my father was living in Birmingham, where I'm actually from, and he recorded it off the affiliate there. And then some of my friends, housemates from university, we went up to Birmingham to see Generations, which was still in the theater.
Right.
And met my dad, and he gave me the videotape, VHS tape. And then we went back to Tuscaloosa and we watched the premiere that had been recorded. But to see the episodes through the first season was a challenge. And so it was harder to get hooked on it because it was something that, well, I had to have my dad record them and then pass me a tape every few weeks. And then there was a short period where they started showing Voyager, I think it was on CBS affiliates. And again, this was 1995, six, right? So I'm a little cloudy about the CBS connection back then, you know, with this being Paramount, Viacom and all, but they started showing it on CBS affiliates at kind of odd times in different cities that didn't have UPN affiliates. And we got that in Tuscaloosa. So for a little while, I was able to watch it. But then they yanked that again, and I couldn't see it again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so then, during the... Well, it was right with the... Right before the Scorpion cliffhanger. So right before Jerry Ryan came aboard a Seven of Nine, that's when I moved to Japan. And so then I had this disconnect where, again, I didn't have access to Voyager anymore. So there's this very disjointed nature of my ability to even watch the show.
Wow.
That happened compared with the other series. You know, TNG started when I was in high school. DS9 started when I was in university. And so I was able to watch those every week as they aired. And I think that's probably the biggest reason. And then also, I think the other thing for me is the competition with Deep Space Nine, because there was so much Star Trek being produced at that time. And compared with Deep Space Nine, Voyager, it felt to me what the writers, I think, intended, what the creators intended, which was a return to the Next Generation format. But the problem was, in such close proximity to those later seasons of The Next Generation, it felt a bit like it didn't measure up to what the TNG actors and writers were doing on that show. Mm-hmm. It really truly felt like a light version of that to me. And so I think those are all factors that affected it. It's not that I don't like Voyager, but it's just in the hierarchy of those first five series, it's at the bottom of the list for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an incredibly, that's an interesting thing as to why it kind of just didn't stick with you. I think, you know, for me, I think as we've talked on the network many times, you know, Voyager was never my favorite series. And in many ways, a big part of that was the same thing that kind of was for you is that, you know, I was so in love with Deep Space Nine as the show. Mm-hmm. And where it was going and what they were doing with the show. I found it to be just so incredibly interesting. And I was loving the characters and all of that, that Voyager never hit the same spot for me that Deep Space Nine did. And I do think a big part of that, like you mentioned, you know, whatever your first Star Trek show is, a lot of times that tends to be something where that's a person's favorite. And Deep Space Nine, so when I got into Star Trek, the show that I really loved, I mean, the show that I was introduced to was the original series. But at the same time, you know, then TNG was on and I kind of got into TNG a little bit. But that show was, by that point, was actually kind of wrapping up very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the show that I really ended up getting into ended up being Deep Space Nine. And by the time that Voyager went on the air in 1995, you know, I was kind of all in on Deep Space Nine. And what that meant then is that Voyager had a lot to do to kind of win me to its side. And again, this is not a reflection on whether or not, you know, Voyager is good or not or anything. That's just kind of where I was coming into the show. And to kind of answer, you know, my own question that I asked you, I think that really it came down to there are a few episodes of Star Trek Voyager that I do really enjoy. And they actually do, stand out to me. I think they're well done. And yet at the same time, it just didn't have the same type of like pull on me that Deep Space Nine did, or even the original series or the Next Generation. I mean, it never quite hit the same way. You know, as, the kids these days say, Deep Space Nine just hit different. And therefore, I was just in that place where I was like, okay, this is kind of going to be what I judge everything else by.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So, well, it's going to be interesting then as we watch through this time, particularly for you, because it's been so long since you watched, I mean, to see how you react to the stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and I will say, like, I hope nobody hears that and thinks, oh, man, he's just going to be a hater this whole time. The thing that I am super excited to dive back into is watching this show because I haven't seen it in so long. So I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to spend time with the characters. And one of the things that I've been finding is that my wife and I have been slowly watching through Star Trek. We've talked about this before, and we're in TNG now. We're in season one. And, you know, season one is the show which I think everybody is like, oh, that was terrible. That was the worst, you know. And yet, what I'm finding is that I'm really enjoying season one. I think it is way better than it is given credit for. And so, I'm excited, actually, then if that's the case that I'm having that with TNG season one, I'm praying that that's the kind of the same experience that I'm going to have with this series. So, yeah, man, let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think with Voyager, it continued the trend that DS9 set after The Next Generation, where the first season of each series I felt was stronger, at least the perception of it when watching it the first time, not necessarily when you go back and rewatch and rewatch mm-hmm. And analyze like we do, but just as a viewer watching, and this continued with Enterprise for me as well, the first seasons feel like they get stronger with each series. And I think it's a result of the creative crew had been together,
yes.
you know, all the way from TNG through the end of Enterprise. They're just refining and polishing, and they're so accustomed to it that they're able to raise the level of their work on a continuous basis. And you see that here.
I think it's a great point. Yeah.
So, well, let's talk about the premise, because I remember being in my car, riding around, listening to the news on the radio, and occasionally they would talk about this new Star Trek series that was in development, even before it had been given the name Voyager. And as news came out about the premise, I was thinking, okay, what are they going to do that's going to be different this time? Because you've got TNG. At that time, TNG was still on, because development of this show was going on, of Voyager was going on in 93. And of course, DS9 was there. So you were on the space station, and this was pre-Defiant. So you have the stationary nature of the show exclusively at that point, pretty much, except for the occasional runabout trip. And word of caution, never get in a runabout and go anywhere. I mean, bad things are going to happen to you, but
it's actually very true.
It's very true. But, you know, what are they going to do that's different? And then news started to trickle out, and it kind of became apparent that this was going to be a return to the TNG style of you've got a crew on a ship, and the ship is the centerpiece of the show, mm-hmm. and they're going to be going places. And if you read, and I'm not going to bring it all up here because there's a lot of information that's super extensive, but in a nutshell, when Rick Berman and Michael Piller and Jerry Taylor were working on the concept for Voyager, they knew that they had to do something to set it apart. And one of the things that kept coming back to them was that, especially on The Next Generation, they would have these episodes where they would get flung across the galaxy by Q or by a wormhole. Something would happen. But they always had to end up back by the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And so they started asking themselves, well, what would happen if we didn't get back? And that gave birth to the idea, the basic idea of Voyager. And then they started talking about, well, what if we have conflict within the crew? And they have this idea that evolved into the Maquis. And also, because Voyager was in development for a couple of years, they were able to set up the Maquis effectively on The Next Generation and on DS9 before Caretaker aired. So when you jump into the story, you automatically know who the Maquis are if you've been watching the other shows, which was an excellent approach. And then they had to figure out, well, how do we deal with the conflict? And is it going to be like a constant conflict going on? Or are the crews going to decide they have to work together? Are they going to become a Starfleet crew? Are we going to give the Maquis Starfleet uniforms? How's that all going to work? And so ultimately, in this episode, Caretaker, we see the final version of all that discussion. So what do you think about the premise of this show?
So the interesting thing about the premise of the show to me is that I think it's a strong premise. So the idea of, hey, we are going to be flung across the far reaches of the galaxy. We're going to be away from Starfleet. We're going to then test in some ways the metal of our characters and what they truly believe, because they're not going to have the backup of the Federation, which, again, I think that all makes for a really great story idea. We're going to have characters that don't all come from the same place. You know, not all of these characters are choosing they don't choose to be Starfleet, right? They get thrust into a position where they have to be Starfleet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is very interesting.
Well, and in the case of Chakotay and B'Elanna, they've chosen not to be Starfleet anymore.
Exactly. Yes. And so I do think that that's really interesting, and therefore I think it creates a good setup. And okay, I think the beauty of this is that, you know, Deep Space Nine set up all these things too. Like, okay, we want to be able to have a show which allows us to be able to have some more back and forth. We want to be able to have characters who don't always agree. We want to be able to have some sort of conflict in the show because, you know, if you're in space and you're dealing with a bunch of different races, it seems logical that not everybody's always going to be of the same opinion. And so This show, in that sense, it seemed like that the idea was, okay, let's follow that mold, right? Let's create a show which allows us to be able to have that type of conflict built into it so that we can, you know, then utilize that for our storytelling. Because as these characters then are faced with all of this stuff coming from the outside, especially the realization then at the end, we are utterly alone. That really should then, if you're looking at the format of the show, okay, we're going to be pushing these characters pretty hard. We're going to be making their lives incredibly difficult. We're going to be making them have to really, you know, we always talk about on the Orb, the idea that Star Trek Deep Space Nine is what took the beliefs of the Federation and put them to the test. And this seems like to me, as we dive into Caretaker, right? That seems like what this show is also wanting to do. Let's put our characters to the test and see whether or not all the things that they actually say that they believe are actually something that they would live by. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's pretty stinking fascinating. And I think just the setup of the show then allows you that opportunity to just have a rip-roaring good time of exploring the human condition. You know, the question always becomes who you are when nobody's watching is really what defines your character. And to me, That's what Voyager seems to be about, right? Who are you going to be when nobody else knows whether or not you're being the quote unquote good Starfleet crew?
Right. Yeah. And that's a message that Janeway continuously tries to share with the crew.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I think, the premise, it was an interesting idea to try to shed. And as we talk about season one, as we go through, we'll see how much they stuck to their guns with the concept of this. But to try to shed the Starfleet Federation wrappings to open up the show to new possibilities and how reliant Star Trek is on those wrappings to connect with the viewer. But to try to do it, I thought was, if you're going to do something different from TNG and Deep Space Nine, this seems like one of the best avenues to take where you're able to retain, for the crew that we're following, you're able to retain the familiar Star Trek wrappings, but you are putting them in a situation where you have an opportunity to introduce new aliens and new cultures and new moral dilemmas for the crew that you wouldn't be able to do if you're still flying around, because the 24th century had gotten very crowded in the alpha and beta quadrants, especially for the Federation.
Yep.
And the idea of introducing conflict, we already had conflict on Deep Space Nine, but the conflict came from Starfleet officers being stationed in a place where they had to work with people who weren't Starfleet and had never had any real exposure to Starfleet and didn't necessarily believe the same things.
Exactly.
And then also you have the faith element with the Bajoran religion, which introduces something. But the station is like a small city, so it's like a community, and you would expect that there's all this diversity, especially with it being, once the wormhole's discovered, it being a waypoint for commerce and exploration in that part of the galaxy. So,
well, and one thing you mentioned that I thought was great is the sense that a big part of this is that how do you return to exploring the great unknown when, you know, all of these shows have spent so much time playing in the same area. And so the way to do that then is to put yourself in a whole new place, you know? And so then you are returning very much to the feel of the original series, where almost every week you were experiencing an alien race or species that nobody had experienced before. And so, you know, on top of the idea of we're going to test the mettle of these characters, we're going to test their character when they truly have nobody watching, we're also going to test them against threats and species and everything that they have no clue about. They've never, I mean, you know, as Neelix even says in the episode, you know, I know of species you've never even heard of.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's also, I think, a thing that as you start Caretaker and you start into Voyager, like, okay, that's also an exciting premise, right? We're not going to be doing the familiar. We're going to be doing the unknown, but we're facing it alone. And that's kind of a terrifying thing, right?
Also a great tagline for the show. I can't believe marketing missed that.
Facing the great unknown alone.
Yeah. Alone, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, apparently I should have been a writer. I just missed out.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting that as much as they were trying to return to the TNG formula because the studio at the time viewed DS9 as a failure, I think that in many ways, Voyager, in terms of its storytelling, its messaging, is a great nod to the original series, even more so than The Next Generation, because as you're describing there, it is returning to the great unknown. And the Caretaker itself in this episode, of course, they didn't have holographic technology in the original series, but you might have something where there's some kind of facade hiding a computer behind it. You know, think about Landru, for example. Here, when they discover that there are the computers behind the walls of the barn, and then later when the holographic matrix is failing and you're starting to be able to see behind it, to me, that just felt like a throwback to Kirk and Spock and Bones being down on a planet somewhere and discovering that, oh, there's actually this computer. Now, I know that the Caretaker himself is a life form. He's not actually a computer.
Life but forms? Did you do da. Tiny little... I'm sorry.
Da. Where are you? Yeah. So, but yeah, it just has this original series feel to it. And we'll see that, I think, in a number of episodes coming up in season one, where I think something that they did effectively here, I said earlier that for me, Voyager, because it felt like this return to TNG and it wasn't quite on par with TNG for me at the time, might be one reason why it didn't. I didn't get hooked on it as much as some people did. But I think one of the great strengths of what they do early on here is that they did break free of this.
I want to break free. Sorry. Just so many songs.
We should do like a TFM album of all the songs that.
But seriously, you're saying that, and like there are just so many references to songs for this.
There are, right? Yeah. So But I think in the 24th century through the Next Generation and DS9, everything had become so crowded and so structured. And so if you're writing, you have to work within this framework that's been created over the course of when you put DS9's early seasons into the mix, over 200 episodes. And what they did with the premise of Voyager, and I think it was effective, is it enabled them to actually go back to the original core foundation of Star Trek, which is exploring, seeking out strange new worlds, which had become more and more difficult to do in the 1990s Star Trek series.
No, I completely agree with you. And you can see where, in some ways, I think the creators do feel as though they've kind of put themselves into a box that they want to be able to get out of, and they don't quite know how to get out of it. And the best way that they can think to get out of it is that, okay, how can we... And this is the beauty, I think, of this in that sense. They are trying to stay true to what they believe Star Trek to be. They're dealing with a situation where they don't believe that Deep Space Nine has been accepted by people as it is these days, where, I mean, like Entertainment Weekly ranks it the best Star Trek series ever. That's not where we are then. So they're trying to figure out, okay, so how do we then create the thing that is going to bring people back to Star Trek and make them excited to watch it again, but at the same time, stay very true to what Star Trek is. And I think that's something really interesting, right? Because that's... I think today's standard is to actually throw that thinking out the window and say we have to completely remake Star Trek. And what they're saying is, no, I think we need to go back to the heart of what Star Trek is. Maybe we missed it or something in Deep Space Nine, even though they didn't, and everybody would see that later on. But I think that's the thing that makes this so interesting. And that's what Voyager is attempting to do. It really is attempting, with Caretaker, with this premise of getting flung across the galaxy. What does it mean to truly brave the unknown and seek out new life and new civilizations? But now we're going to do that in a place where we have no help, no one around, and we have to decide, are we going to live out our beliefs as Starfleet officers and members of the Federation? And are we going to do that with a crew who a third of them don't believe in that same type of thing in the same way that we might, right?
Yeah,
I think that is, when you think about that as an idea, that's a great idea for a Star Trek show, right?
And what's also interesting about what they did with the setup, and as we talk about how DS9 was viewed at the time, and they're trying to craft a Star Trek series that they think will connect better with the fans, but I think it shows how seasoned Berman and Piller and Taylor were as writers, that they gave themselves an out in case the viewers rejected the concept of being lost on the other side of the galaxy. Yes. And they did that by revealing that there's another caretaker. So that gave them the ability that if the ratings were bad and the show wasn't working and they felt like they needed to retool it again and bring it back into the familiar Federation space, they had a way to do it without having to make up something crazy along the way.
Yeah.
And also it's mentioned in a way where it still connects with the caretaker, the Banjo Man, as we see him in this episode. And it connects with the story and how he was essentially abandoned by his companion.
Yeah.
And he's left there and he feels like he must care for the Ocampa. But it's great writing to just drop that in, knowing that somewhere down the road, we might need this to get ourselves out of a mistake that we've made and allow the series to recover. Yeah. And of course, they didn't need it for that purpose. Mm-hmm. but they did use it again anyway.
Yeah.
In other stories. So.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think, you know, in some ways, when we're talking about this idea, right, Ed, isn't that kind of what Deep Space Nine did, though? And one of the things talk about on the Orb all the time, they created this show where they were leaving all of these threads that they could pull on at any point and create other stories. And that didn't mean they were going to do that, but they left themselves those openings just in case they wanted to use them. And there were points where they decided to use them. So I think, you know, that shows that the writers of Voyager really get that. We can always course correct, no pun intended, if we need to. Mm-hmm. And that allows us to be able to play around with this show and experiment and all that kind of stuff as well. And if we don't feel like it's working, you know, we can make a big change if we want to. And that's actually pretty smart too. So, I mean, well done on them to be thinking ahead in this way.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the way that Voyager is set up, they could, let's just say in the third season, they felt like we've really got to go back to Federation space. They could just run across a wormhole that takes them back, right? But as the viewer, you would feel cheated. It would be like, oh, isn't that convenient that that's here? But by establishing this out in the pilot episode, if you need to use it later, then the viewers don't feel cheated by it. You feel like, oh, yeah, that's right. There is another caretaker out here.
I think that's a good point. And that what you're doing for the series is you're making sure that you know, you kind of have all your ducks in a row. And again, you know, as we're talking about the idea of the premise of the show and what they decide to do with that premise, and when you think about, you know, our reminiscence of like watching the show the first time, like, I think it allowed us to be able to have a really good feeling kind of coming into the show. You could be excited for it. It was something that felt like it had a lot behind it, you know, like I'm looking forward to this. And so, yeah, I mean, that's when you're doing a show that's, you know, in a series like Star Trek, that is basically what you want. I think you want to feel excited about what's coming. And I think they, you know, did a great job with that. So,
and there's another thing about Voyager, a reason for you and me to appreciate Voyager greatly, which is that when the studio turned all of its attention to Voyager, that allowed Deep Space Nine's writers to really enrich that show and do whatever they wanted to, because the studio was kind of like,
they didn't care.
All of our ducks are in this basket with Voyager because the network has to succeed. So you guys on DS9, just do your thing. It's okay. Whatever you want, go for it. And there's so many aspects of DS9 that probably would have been vetoed by executives if they were watching closely. And instead, that show was able to evolve in a way that really no other Star Trek series has ever been able to evolve. And so that's another benefit of Voyager.
Yeah. I mean, which is really, really fascinating. Like, honestly, it's the thing that it's one of those places where if you don't believe there's a God, you're like, huh, there's something to that, right? Like, thank God that's the way this turned out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm also trying to figure out right now my mixed metaphors here. I put ducks in a basket. I think it's eggs in a basket. What do you do? Put ducks in a row and then Neelix cooks them up, and you've never tasted Peking duck until you've tasted a Neelix's Leola root Peking duck. I'm sure that's in the Voyager cookbook. One thing I put on our outline that it just kind of stood out to me when I was rewatching this time is the sort of bait and switch we get with the crew, where we feel like we're being introduced to Voyager's crew, and then bunch of them get killed, and actually the real crew is under our noses the whole time. I thought that was just kind of a fun way to get into the show, I suppose. It's not necessarily fun, and I know our friend Keith DeCandido had mentioned when he was going through Voyager that it's kind of disappointing that at the end of 2 hours, no one seems to even care that all these Starfleet officers died. But the way that we're introduced to the crew in this show is different from any other show.
Yes. And from my recollection with the research that I have done kind of with the behind the scenes type of stuff is that was pretty intentional. You know, they wanted you to get the sense of the characters and who they were, and they wanted you to feel like you were the focus was on the characters. The focus mm-hmm. was getting to know the characters. And mm-hmm. I do find that to be really, really interesting. Because I think one of the things that they you know, when it came to Deep Space Nine and people's thoughts on Deep Space Nine, especially the studio, I think they thought that the premiere was too cerebral, and what they wanted was people to be able to feel more comfortable with the characters and really felt like they get to know the characters. And I do think that is an interesting thing, right? Like, that's one of those places where you can see them making a course correction. And that's pretty interesting that they felt like that. Now, I don't agree with them on that, but that was the focus. That, I mean, they're specifically introducing these characters in this way on purpose because they felt like they didn't do as good a job on that with Deep Space Nine. And they wanted to make sure that people felt comfortable with these characters more quickly than they did feel like they thought the audience did with Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one thing. I think it's Michael Piller who had commented on that about the DS9 characters. And I really don't understand that viewpoint of DS9 because I think DS9 does an excellent job of introducing the characters right out of the gate and helping us get to know them. So I'm not sure why he felt like they had fallen short on that in DS9 and needed to do it better with Voyager. But
I mean, you know, to quote that James Bond song, you know, nobody does it better. It is interesting to me, the same with you, is that they did feel like that the characters did not get as introduced. But I mean, maybe that's something that we should talk about then, is, you know, Caretaker is all about introducing us to the characters of Voyager. And that's their the desire, is that we would come away with a good sense of who they are. Do you feel like that's what you get when you watch this show, and now that you rewatch it? You know, it's not a show that we've spent as much time rewatching as the other series. Mm-hmm. So do you feel like, you know, Janeway and, you know, Tom Paris and all the others are characters to which you're like, oh, yeah, I feel like I know who this person is by watching this show?
I think that I feel like I know who the character is as the writers saw them as they were writing the pilot, not necessarily as the characters turn out to be. And I don't even mean evolving over the course of 7 seasons. I mean, someone like Belana, I think, settles down into a somewhat different character very quickly.
Yeah.
I think she comes across as very, nothing against Roxanne Dawson, she does an excellent job with the performance in this episode, but I think the character, and this is hard, of course, for any actor, right out of the gate, understanding who a character is, especially in a science fiction setting like this. But I think Belana comes across as a bit more of this cliched Klingon in Caretaker, and then quickly settles into being a more rounded character as the season progresses. Tom Paris, you know, I guess he's pretty close in this episode. Tuvok is Tuvok for sure. Neelix, we don't see that much of, but you can certainly see where that character is going here. And Chakotay, I also think, evolves. Well, he kind of evolves in this episode, which we can talk about a little bit. But then he also quickly becomes more well-rounded. And I don't know, you know, we're talking about DS9. I don't know that this differs really in any way from what we saw in DS9 either. I think it's probably pretty similar in terms of how the characters are depicted in the pilot episode and then how they evolve over the next few episodes. The one that really stands out to me, and we can talk about it in a moment after you share your thoughts on the characters, is Janeway, which I think it's incredible. It's like Kate Mulgrew walked into this and was just Janeway.
Yeah.
From the moment she steps on the set in a way that...
Oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, you know, Avery Brooks is great as Sisko, Patrick Stewart's great as Picard, but I think Kate Mulgrew encompasses, or she portrays Janeway from the first moment in a way that they did not portray Sisko or Picard from the very, very first moment.
I think that the only characters that did that beforehand was Shatner with Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
Even Archer has to grow a little bit into kind of like being a little bit more comfortable with himself. Mm-hmm. I think he's probably the closest next to Shatner and Mulgrew, but yes. So, no, as per the question of, you know, how they actually do with introducing the characters, one of the things that I was really fascinated with this rewatch is the way in which they do a very good job of basically setting up what all of the most important relationships in the show are going to be. So Tom and Harry, the dynamic with the doctor, you know, this captain and how she's going to feel about her crew. I think even the relationship between her and Tuvok is really well set up and is completely, you know, it's set for what we're going to get for the rest of the series. I think the relationship between B'Elanna and Harry and that dynamic, this very like, it's kind of like that antagonistic brother-sister kind of relationship. Of course, Kes and Neelix are set up for, you know, how they're going to develop in the show in many ways. And so a lot of that is really well done. I think that the best characters set up, aside from Janeway, Tom Paris is exactly who that character is going to be. And I don't think anybody else in the cast other than Mulgrew completely fills the role in the way that Robbie Duncan McNeil does with Paris, in the sense that he just is Paris. He exudes everything that character is. Yeah. And in fact, you can actually, as you're watching it, you almost get this sense of like, okay, I can see where this character's going to go and the story arcs that we're going to kind of be playing out with that character.
Yeah.
I think you rightly pointed out, you know, B'Elanna is the character that's probably going to change the most in the sense that they're going to deal less with her just kind of being this almost like emotional teenager. And more along the lines of her kind of having to come to grips with trauma and family issues and things like that. And so, I think they really do a great job of kind of introducing you to who the characters are. And then again, we introduced perfectly that Harry Kim is the almost fish out of water. I just got into Starfleet. I literally know nothing about anything yet other than what I learned at the Academy. And so again, that's where that whole dynamic with him and Tom comes in. So I think in that stuff, they do a great job.
Yeah. I think for Robbie Duncan McNeil, he had the easiest route in the sense that Tom Paris is Nick Locarno. It's the same character, essentially. Yeah. And in fact, the character was called Nick Locarno in the early development of this show. And McNeil mentioned that when he first read the sides to do the audition, that it said Tom, but he said, this just sounds like Nick Locarno. And he thought he was auditioning for Nick Locarno to make another appearance in one episode of TNG or in Generations or something like that.
That's so interesting.
And so, you know, clearly they liked his performance as a Nick Locarno. And I feel like he did have to audition. Like, it wasn't like they just went to him and handed him the role, but it feels a little bit like how with Enterprise, they wanted Scott Bakula for Archer from the start. Like, they knew, like, this is the actor who is we're modeling this character for, and we want him. It almost feels like they knew that this character is Robbie Duncan McNeil.
Yeah.
And also, as we come to find out later in the series, Tom's dad keeps a photo of Nick Locarno on his desk at Federation headquarters. And so,
exactly. Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you? Sense. You know, just such a lovable guy, honestly. So,
yeah. But what are your thoughts on Kate Mulgrew? Now, it's very well known, of course, that Genevieve Bujold was first cast as Janeway. The first few days didn't go well. She quickly departed. I know we've watched the limited footage that's been put out there in the extras, and it's just clear to anybody watching that wasn't going to work. And this show, for me anyway, and I think most any Voyager fan would agree, that this show hinges on the character of Janeway. It is an ensemble cast, and they do use the characters as an ensemble cast, but Janeway is the linchpin that makes this show work. And it's so critical that casting is correct. But beyond just recasting and not having Bujold be Janeway, it feels like if Kate Mulgrew had not been cast as Janeway, it's hard for me to imagine this show working as well as it did.
Okay. This is the thing about this show. And we did kind of mention it earlier, and I think you're 100% right that she saves the day. Her portrayal is so perfect. She nails exactly what they want. They want a female to be a captain that's a female. They want a woman to be captain who doesn't captain the same way that the men captain. They want that feeling of the motherliness. They want that feeling of the softness and yet toughness at the same time. And I was just astounded by how well every choice that Mulgrew makes. It just feels, you know, you have those characters. And again, I think Shatner is a perfect example of this, where that person is that person. You know, it's like Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones. And Kate Mulgrew is Captain Janeway. And in all of the choices there's that moment where she's talking to Tuvok and she's just the way she's sitting, the way she's longingly kind of looking out at the stars, trying to wrap her head around what just happened with her command here that did not go. I mean, this day did not go the way she thought it was going to go. Right.
Right.
And her desire to want to grow close to her crew, to be a part of her crew, to really create relationships with her crew. But at the same time, as she's looking out that window, you know exactly what she's thinking. And she's thinking about Mark and that their dog is having a baby and she's not there. And she doesn't even know if she'll be back there. And that's beautiful because it's such a human reaction. And there's a reaction in there that makes her feel like the female captain that we want to get to know more of. So, yes, I mean, this is the thing that I was kind of surprised about rewatching the show and rewatching Caretaker was how just pitch perfect she is. From, like, the first second she's on screen.
Yeah. I mean, the nuances in the delivery of lines is incredible. And particularly when you take into account the casting issues with Janeway and then Kate Mulgrew being cast, and then they restart shooting, and how quickly she has to jump into this part and learn these lines, and you would never know. I mean, it's so natural. Mm-hmm. The conversation she's having with Mark when he's on the view screen. You mentioned her and Tuvok earlier. You really feel like, yeah, they've known each other for a long time, and she's so relieved that he's back.
Yeah.
It really, for someone to embody a character like that in the fifth season of a TV show, of course you expect that. But in the pilot episode, when you are the person who's been cast to replace the person who's already been shooting, it just, yeah, it's quite amazing. It's extremely impressive how she steps into this role and how she anchors this show. And yeah, it just gives the show its character.
Well, and I think the beauty of it is that this show literally doesn't work without her.
Right.
And I do mean the word literally.
Yeah.
Because she inhabits this character, and she is the thing that you have to believe, because, and this is the hard part, I think, about the show, right? The most difficult part about the show is that the decision that she then has to make to leave them stranded on the other side of the galaxy,
mm-hmm.
you have to be cool with. And she's the one who has to sell it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And if she doesn't do that, then you're going to have a problem in this show. And she does it. And mm-hmm. and I think that's the thing. Again, it's what makes her so great in this series. And I think I'm just, you know, it's hard to feel like, oh, I don't want to feel like I'm just overpraising her. But I really do truly feel as though they don't have her, they got nothing. And so I can't wait, honestly, to continue watching the show, because I'm really mm-hmm. just interested to see, you know, that her portrayal continue to grow. Because it's like, okay, if this person is this good now,
mm-hmm.
dude, how, I mean, come on. Like, what, seriously? Yeah.
So let's jump into, as a last key point, to talk about that decision to strand the crew and how she sells it. I mentioned earlier that Chakotay feels like he evolves a bit in this story. And the moment that I think of most when I say that is near the end, when B'Elanna asks, who is she to be making this decision for us? And Chakotay says she's the captain. And I think that, and at this point, we don't know Chakotay's background, right? We don't know about his connection to the Academy and Starfleet very much, or any of this stuff. So I think that it shows that she inspired him enough for him to trust her, knowing that it means it's going to be a hard journey back home. But instead of fighting her on this decision, you know, he trusts her and he goes mm-hmm. along with the decision. So there's that. And then the other thing, the main thing to talk about here, that it also, because I haven't watched this episode in a while, you know, I mean, I have seen this episode thousands of times, or maybe hundreds of times, or I don't know, maybe 50 times, but
a lot
the
of
thing
times.
That stood out, the thing that stood out to me this time is in the moment with Janeway and Tuvok, where Tuvok asks, do you want me to initiate the program, whatever he calls it, to send them home? And Janeway decides that she can't abandon the Ocampa. There's this tension between what I see as the prime directive, which is so often held up in Star Trek, versus Federation ideals, because the Prime Directive is, I guess this is more of a Starfleet thing than a Federation thing, but I know that within Star Trek, the distinction between the Federation and Starfleet itself is kind of blurred. But the Federation ideals are to help people, whereas the Prime Directive is telling you, I know you want to help people, but you can't, because if you do, you're interfering with the natural development of another world. And so here we have the two colliding, and there is no time to have a staff meeting and discuss anything. You've got to make a decision right now. And the fact that Janeway and Tuvok are so close and know each other so well and respect each other so much and trust one another, but they have different views on this issue and a decision has to be made immediately, I thought was one of the highlights from a Star Trek element in this story, that they captured the core of Star Trek here in the debate that Star Trek has about how we treat each other, help each other, mm-hmm. when we should interfere, when we shouldn't interfere, and so forth. What did you think about that moment?
This is probably the part of the episode that I felt like maybe they did not do the best. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason that is for me is because the way the episode is written, this isn't the only decision, because you could easily have set those cobalt devices on the array to blow up seconds after you go home.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to make this decision. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thing that makes that interesting. So if there's any quibble that I have with the episode, I would have liked the decision that they had almost to be, I don't know, almost made for them. I get what they're mm-hmm. trying to do, that they're trying to make this about the morality of choosing, that we're going to put these mm-hmm. people first and all those type of things. But it's like that you can, mm-hmm. the problem is that you also leave this wiggle room where I'm like, I can kind of see where they don't actually have to make this decision. And that's kind mm-hmm. of a little bit bothersome, because mm-hmm. then it does make us wanting to like blame Janeway later on. Mm-hmm. It's something that you could, you know, want to do. And so, yeah, I mean, but other than that, I think the fact that Chakotay is like, hey, she's the captain, and he gets that because he understands this. I mean, he understands Starfleet enough, and he understands this world that they've now been pulled into of Starfleet mm-hmm. enough to know that we don't question the captain like that. Behind closed doors, mm-hmm. I'm the first officer. I'm going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But everybody else, yeah. that's the way the chain of command works. And I think he rightly understands, and maybe this is me reading into the episode, but it, mm-hmm. it seems like, okay, if we're making this decision, then the chain of command might be the only thing that keeps us alive.
Yeah, right.
And so I think that's a big part of it as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's fine. And I think it's well done for the most part. I don't, you know, dislike it or anything. I just do kind of wish that it was a little bit differently written, so that I, as I was watching it, I was like, they actually don't have to do that. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's clear cut that they don't have to do it, because various things could go wrong.
I mean, I'm sure all that's the case too.
Yeah. But it is true that like the simplest way that it would work in a typical Star Trek story.
Yeah, we set the charges and then we go.
You set the charges and you go, and then it blows up. Yeah.
So then
UPN would have had to rely on Platypus Man to carry the new network if the premise of this show had already been erased at the end of the pilot episode. So
I love that.
Yeah. It's too bad that they didn't have an episode in season one, and it would have had to have been in season one since Platypus Man didn't get renewed, but where they visited a planet of platypus people. That would have made an excellent tie-in.
It would have definitely been very interesting.
Yeah, you do a crossover. Yeah. All right. So we're at the end of the story. At the end, the crews come together. The Maquis get Starfleet uniforms. This is something we can discuss on a future episode of To the Journey and what that does to the conflict element that they were trying to establish here at the start of the series. But what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for the pilot Caretaker?
Yeah, I find this show, this episode to be really interesting. And I think what makes it interesting is that the premise is big and bold. They are obviously, I think, at this, like when you're watching this episode, you're like, okay, this is, they're like, the fact that we were both there too, you know, we understand a lot of the behind the scenes and in a lot of ways we realize they're swinging for the fences. Mm-hmm. And they are kind of like taking a big risk. Like you said, they even gave themselves of an out, you know? Mm-hmm. And I like this episode. Now, it's not my favorite premiere. I think that I would still rate Emissary and Broken Bow over this premiere. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, of all the premieres that we've seen, this is actually one of the strongest. I think maybe it's a little too action focused.
Yeah, sometimes. Although that was one of their goals. Yeah.
Yes, which is exactly. So they, I mean, they nail their goal, but I don't necessarily think it works as well as they want it to, because I do think that there could possibly have been a little bit more time just with the characters themselves, and that would have been nice. But all in all, I think I'm just going to give this a good solid 4 out of 5. 4 out of 5 destroyed arrays, you know, because now we're lost in the Delta Quadrant, and we're here. So I guess as long as we've got coffee, that's all I care about. But I mean, Chris, what do you think? What are you going to rate this one? Especially, you know, finding yourself back in the Delta Quadrant after really not spending too much time here recently.
Yeah. Well, I have very fond memories of the premiere, the story I shared at the beginning of our discussion about getting the VHS tape from my dad, taking it back down. I still remember to this day how, of course, back then the TVs were CRT TVs with the tubes, not like the things we have these days. And I remember that my TV couldn't handle the brightness of the sun when Voyager comes around.
Oh, wow.
And every time I would play that, and it wasn't just this pilot episode, it was like every episode that I watched on that TV for the first season anyway, the image would scroll up and down.
Wow.
When this Voyager comes around and I think the flame starts, is that right? It's like very bright. Yeah. And my TV would go crazy and just the image would start scrolling up and down and then it would settle back down. And
wow,
it was just
that's
strange,
fascinating.
I don't know exactly what triggered it, but I still can picture that happening. So yeah, I have fond memories of the premiere and fond memories of following the development of the show before it premiered. And it was just such a wonderful time to be a Star Trek fan back then, because
I agree.
We got so much. Is it 18 years? We had new Star Trek every week, except for the summer breaks, of course, when there were reruns. But we had new Star Trek coming all the time. And it was all interconnected. And that was the other thing where, you know, the last 5, 6 years, 7 years here, we've been getting a lot of Star Trek, but they're different shows and they're set in different time periods. And back then, everything was linked together. And so you felt like you were in this world of Star Trek, like you were living in it. And then here we got this show that built on that. And it still felt familiar, but it gave us new things and So I loved it at the time. And as a pilot, I think Caretaker, I'm with you, actually. Emissary is my favorite pilot for a story. Broken Bow is my favorite pilot for just the production value of it. And also the story is great. But I think Caretaker is also an excellent pilot. It has a good story. If you pay attention, I think they do a really good job of setting up the situation with the Caretaker and the Ocampa early in the episode, yeah, where you don't pay attention. And then when you get to the end, it comes full circle and it pays off and it makes the story really work. And then if you go back and you watch it again, then you catch that stuff at the beginning. And I think it's good writing, mm-hmm, to put that in at the beginning and yes, do it in a way where, like, it doesn't feel like they're setting something up where you can predict what's going to happen, but it's actually there and it pays off. So I think it's written well. And I think the production value is great. They were under a lot of pressure because the later seasons of TNG in particular look so polished. The Emissary pilot was so well done. And here, the success of UPN is hanging on the success of Voyager. So they were under a lot of pressure, and I think they did a really excellent job with it. So I really enjoy it. Like you, I'm looking forward to jumping into the next episode and the rest of season one and the whole series. But as for Caretaker, I'm going to give it 9 Sporocystian life forms.
Oh, fantastic.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Caretaker. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's a closed group just for listeners. So if you are joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners there. Of course, you can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show. Choose to the journey. And that'll come to Matthew and me through some kind of subspace wormhole or something. It's a long way from the Delta Quadrant, but it'll get to us.
Chris, I think it'll get to us, though, in a blink of an eye.
I think so. Yes, yes, yes. And you can also find us on social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and all the other rewatches and the other shows like 602 Club that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, please go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your help. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. And now, Matthew, when you're not coming to the realization that your first need is Neelix, where can people find you?
Well, people can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02, of course, here on the network in the 602 Club, as well as all of our other shows that we're doing, Chris. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with 2 shows. One is called Owl Post with Dre Kaufman, talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series on that show, and then Aggressive Negotiations, as John Mills and I are talking about Star Wars each and every week. Now, Chris, if people want to catch up with you and reminisce about their memories of watching Voyager for the first time 30 years ago, where can they find you?
Well, if you want to reminisce, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active these days. So if you're on there, catch me there. But I am on all the platforms. So just send me a message. You can also find me elsewhere on the network. As you mentioned, Matthew, doing those shows with you. And also you can find me in the back catalog in many shows. And check that out if you'd like to hear more of my thoughts on Star Trek. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we're going to be discussing Parallax.
Well, Chris, that sounds like it's going to be a very good time, but set course for home.